I think the most beautiful part of doing that film for me was talking to Desiree Washington's father, who was a very big boxing fan. And when Desiree called and said, you know, Daddy, I went out with Mike Tyson. And he went, oh, that's wonderful. Wait till I tell your grandfather, and that's terrific. And she said, oh, no, no, it wasn't very good. He raped me. And then the father said that he ran, you know, he went to go see his daughter, and that he went to hug her. And as he put his arms around her to hug her, she put her hands against his chest to pull him away from her. And he knew at that point that he had lost his daughter, that his daughter, who wanted to be president of the United States and had all these lofty dreams, that this had dramatically changed her, this experience.
This is Adam Shartoff, and you're listening to FilmWax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films.
Hey, this is Adam Shartoff, and you're listening to FilmWax Radio, episode number 200. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you for listening. We have arrived at this milestone episode. I'm grateful to have your attention and for you to have chosen to listen to this episode. As you heard from the opening, that was, of course, Barbara Koppel, who is my guest for this entire episode, talking about her experience making the documentary Fallen Champ, the Mike Tyson documentary. Barbara Koppel, let's see. I had been pursuing getting Barbara Koppel on the podcast for a few months, at least. I mean, she's been on my mind for a long time, but I was always thinking since I started this, wouldn't it be great to get Barbara Koppel? But it was not until the last, I'd say, a few months where I, in earnest, moved things along a little faster, stepped up, and was trying different tactics to get her onto the show. And I ran into her this past holiday season, early January, at Al Maisel's house, where they he and his wife had this annual potluck party. And I went over there, and Barbara Koppel was there. And I approached her, and I didn't want to ambush her with it, but I said to her, you know, Al was on my podcast recently. I do this podcast, and you know, it's all about supporting independent films and independent filmmakers. And, you know, I just want you to know that you're probably going to end up on it anyway, so I'm just letting you know about it. Trying to kind of be tongue-in-cheek about it, and she smiled. And then at the same time, I happen to know a colleague of hers I met a couple years back who works at Cabin Creek, where they, you know, their production company in Lower Manhattan, and I had been emailing him with him, and finally he was able to find a good week where she was around and where she would be able to commit some time, and so finally did indeed go up there and I hung out with her, and she was very, very, very generous. She gave me as much time, she really did, as I needed. And I didn't want to abuse that privilege, so I just kind of cut it off after a little off, after an hour or an hour and 15 minutes. But she has a new film in the works about the singer Sharon Jones. Maybe you've heard of the group Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings. They're currently on tour. We're going to play a little of the music in a little bit. But she was giving me a little bit of information about that experience. You know, we'll be able to see the movie later this year. And so I'm hoping maybe around that time I can get together with Barbara Koppel again. Barbara Koppel, if you haven't seen her films, you're about to get a nice primer, because we talk about a number of her films in this conversation. She's perhaps, I would say probably even to this day, the most known for Harlan County, USA, and filmed this strike that was going on in Harlan County with these miners, and she ended up getting the Oscar for it. It certainly put her on the map. And since then, she's been coming out with a movie every year or two. She's very prolific, having made films about Mike Tyson, Woody Allen, the Dixie Chicks, many other topics on all subjects. And so there's quite a versatility to what she does. And she is at this point sure to be an icon. And yet, very down-to-earth, very gracious and lovely. And so what we'll do is we'll go to my conversation with Barbara Koppel, and then I'll come back afterwards and chat with you. And then the first thing I did when I sat with Barbara is I played her this clip that, because I had just come from, like, I think the day before, from talking to Liz Garbus, the documentary filmmaker who is like a disciple of Barbara's, and they're friend, very good friends. So I started the conversation by playing this clip, which you're about to hear right now, and then we'll dive right into the episode 200 with Barbara Koppel.
Yes. Kind. When I first got to Sundance in 1997 and I had the farm, and Barbara Koppel was like this giant figure to me. And I walked into some, she had a film there that year. It was the Woody Allen Wild Man Blues.
Yeah, because I was going to say she had already made, of course, Harlan County and
American Dream.
So I think
a Tyson film. And then, so then it was Wild Man Blues. And I walked into some reception. It was probably the first moment I got there for the competition filmmakers or whatever. And there was this woman, like Barbara, she was like, Liz, I'm so, and she was so warm. And I felt like I had just like hit the jackpot. Like I went into a party and Barbara welcomed me. You know, I felt like such an imposter. I felt scared. How did I get in here? How is this happening? Is anyone going to like the film? And then there was Barbara Koppel welcoming me. And I see her doing that all the time with new filmmakers coming up.
Yes.
And I'm very conscious of that. I try to repeat that as well.
So you've influenced not only did you make a difference to her, but you also, she takes that with her. It's really moving in a way.
Well, Liz Garbus is just wonderful.
Yeah, she
She's
is.
She's just an extraordinary filmmaker. I'm so proud of her. And just the work that she's done, Love, Marilyn and Bobby Fischer and just all of it. She does it with such panache and she's so much fun to be around.
And she's a great storyteller.
Yeah.
What I love also about conversations like these is I do all my homework, so I try to see as much as I can going into an interview, you know, so I'm prepared. But it's a treat because of that. I had not seen There's Something Wrong with Aunt Diane, I think it was called.
Yeah, so
there's
right. Something, that was an amazing.
Oh, my God.
It was so gripping, and it just took you. I mean, you were so scared for those children and those people and the horror that came from it all.
Yeah, I saw that. That's normally the way you talk about a narrative film, which is kind of what kind of came up during it. It's like very true. It was put together with the suspense and the tension of a narrative film, you know. Anyway, I wanted to play that for you just to start it off because I thought
you should
hear that.
No, she's just wonderful. I mean,
that's universal, you know, too, from what I get.
Well, I think that all of us as filmmakers love each other and we're really good friends and we each want the other to succeed, and that's extremely important. I just got back from L.A. a day ago, and I was a moderator for the Academy for the feature-length documentaries, and just being able to talk to them and ask them questions on stage with the Samuel Goldwyn Theater, and it was packed. I mean, 900 people. There wasn't a seat open, and just how beautiful and articulate they are and how their films just really challenge you so much and really let you understand the world around you and how they talk about it and the passion. And it just, you know, makes me really happy to be in this community and part of it.
It's a perk because it's not why you go into it. You go into it because you have this passion for telling stories. And
well, but I think part of it is also the people that you're in there, you know, with them, because to be able to see how documentary has grown from when I first started. I mean, just looking at the Academy, I mean, when I did Harlan County, the distributor got very mad at me when I submitted it because then he'd have to tell people it was a documentary. I had nowhere to stay. I had to borrow a dress.
This is for the Oscars you're talking about.
This is for the Oscars, yeah. And it was just a whole different world. And now there are dinners and there's question and answers, and there's lunches, and documentaries are celebrated as they should be. And it's just a whole different world.
We're actually having this conversation. Barbara Koppel here on Film Wax Radio. I kind of have to remind myself that, and that it's the 200th episode. So it's, thank you for that, coming on and making time for this. As you mentioned, though, you did just get back from L.A., where we just had the Oscars this past Sunday night. And first of all, to my memory, in the many years that I've been, you know, alive and watching the Oscars, or aware of them anyway, I don't remember such a good year of films in general. But when I look at the five nominees for Best Documentary, besides just the fact that I've met and talked to all five nominees, which was a first for, you know, me. I was saying that next year I'm going to go for the Best Supporting Actress category.
Why not? So, you could do it all.
Yeah, but I do gravitate towards the documentaries myself. It was an amazing group of films, you know. I think they really, truly all deserved being celebrated, you know.
Yeah, I mean, each person had so much passion, the producers and the directors, and given the flourish to really talk about what their films meant to them, were amazing. And some of them risked their lives. And
yeah.
And they just did everything they possibly could to bring a gripping and beautiful story. And they're so intelligent about the work that they did. I mean, it was just, I was awestruck by all five of them.
You mentioned, you were talking about your experience a little bit about around the time of when Harlan County was nominated through its actually winning. The climate, we all know there wasn't really documentaries. No wonder, you know, your distributor was angry because there was no category for documentaries. Nobody thought of documentaries as a viable type of film that would be commercially successful. Or that was 1970, remind me the year that would, or is it 76? 76?
Yeah.
Our bicentennial. So what was going on at that time in your mind, especially once you finished it, how people were gonna see the film?
Okay.
Did you think about that?
Yeah, of course I thought about that. Except I didn't think anybody would really see it because there weren't really any outlets for documentary. And I remember submitting it to the New York Film Festival. And it was 16 millimeter and also 16 track. So they weren't married. And so I called them up and I said, you know, I have this film I'd like to submit. And they said, well, you know, how are we going to do it? And I said, well, I'll do a cue sheet for you. I'll get a double system projector. I'll do whatever you want. And they said, no, 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 we don't do that. And I said, oh, yes, you do. I said, you're doing one on the Hell. You're looking at the Hell's Angels, and that's the same. And they said, okay, bring it up. So I brought it up. We stayed up all night. We did cue sheets. We did everything for it. And I remember bringing it there, dropping it off, coming back downtown, and then they told me, you know, come back in about 2 hours and pick it up. And so I did. And there were all these people standing around. And I thought, the film broke. Something terrible has happened. Why are they all standing there? And I walked in and they said, they loved it. They loved it. And Richard Rowd,
who wanted to meet you.
Richard Rowd, who was head of the festival, they said he only went to the bathroom once during the film.
Was he an older guy?
What? I don't know. Yeah.
But based on...
But
maybe,
I guess he must...
There's a right. relationship between the number of times he goes to the bathroom and
right.
how much he like, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, that's the point.
So,
yeah.
I mean, that was a big point
that
he made.
That's funny.
And so then I got back down, town, and it was... I got a phone call, and they said, we would love to have your film in the festival. And I said, well, I don't know if I want to let you see it. And they said, what? And I said, yep. And they said, don't be an idiot, Barbara. I said, okay, I won't.
You held out for a few moments, though.
Yes,
that's
because
good.
They weren't going to show the film. And they said, so, and I had always called it the Miners film. Mm-hmm. It didn't have the title.
Hmm.
And so Richard and I were on the phone and trying to figure out what a good title would be, because, you know, that's always the hardest thing. And so he said, you know, what about Harlan County? I said, cool. All right, Harlan County, USA. He said, good. Goodbye, goodbye. Took 2 minutes of what we had been struggling with, you know, for
months. So was the director
months.
Of the festival.
Yep. Yeah, Richard Rao.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's a great story.
Yeah, it was fun.
So that was the launch. That was your premiere?
That was the premiere.
Your first documentary premiered at the New York Film Festival?
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I got the 16mm printout 3 days before it was supposed to show. And I invited the coal miners and their wives, and they came, and wow. Hazel Dickens, and I printed out song sheets for the last song of the film, They'll Never Keep Us Down. And I had them put in all the programs.
Oh, the lyrics, right.
The lyrics, yeah.
So people could sing along.
Yes.
If they so chose.
And so they have this, you know, thing where you have to stand on the balcony, and
yep.
if people like it, they clap. And I said, I don't want to do that. I said, at the end of the film, I just want to go on with all the coal miners and their wives and Hazel Dickens and get people to sing. And they said, we don't do that here. I said, well, but that's what we want to do. And so we did it. And it was just wonderful. People were yeah. standing up and singing, and the coal miners and their wives came out and sang, and Hazel sang, and it was great. And then during the question and answer, one of the characters in the film, Lois Scott, who used to keep a gun in her bra, had just been made the head of the Black Lung Association, mm-hmm. and that's from the inhalation of coal dust mm-hmm. in your lungs. And so she decided that this was a perfect place to fundraise. And so she started asking people for donations. And there we were at Alice Tully Hall, and people were throwing $5 and $10 bills on the stage.
Yeah, well, apparently they don't do that at the New York Film Festival either.
Right. And at the end of the festival, Richard Rowd said, well, next year, Barbara, you're going to do it on roller skates? And I said, yeah, that sounds like fun. Anyway, it was wonderful.
So the logical question, and I'm hoping I'm a good avatar for anybody listening, is that where did this come from? Where did the nerve come from to rub against, you know, you're such a pretty young woman. So I'm just like, where did the chutzpah derive from?
Well, I think growing up with my parents, they were extremely loving, and they always said, there's nothing that you can't do, and just go out there and do the things that you feel are right. And it was also, you know, the period before that was the 60s, so it was also a pretty rebellious time where people marched against the Vietnam War and, you know, women power and feeling like you could really change the world. And so I guess I incorporated some of that into the work that I was doing and didn't ever learn to take no for an answer.
I'm glad you didn't. I'm sure many other people are, too. Well, it's true. 76, 77, this would have been probably right in the midst of what we called women's lib. And Bella Abzug was in New York. She was probably congresswoman at the time. Yeah. So it was good timing in many ways. But you were also on the making a film where you were out of your element, I assume, and there were people with guns at certain points during the film, and just managed to keep your head and not waver.
Before I went to Harlan County, I was doing Miners for Democracy. And W.A. Tony Boyle was put into jail for the murder of Joseph Jock Yablonski, who ran against him. And so there was this whole movement throughout the coal fields where, you know, those from below and average coal miners mm-hmm. were going to win. So I went following Arnold Miller around before I ever went to Harlan County and meeting Nimrod Workman, and who was an old coal miner, and having them sing songs. And this song sort of connected everybody, and you really got an essence of who the people were and the struggles that they went through. And it was a very passionate time.
Harlan, Kentucky is coal country, where men work long hours for short wages, where poverty, black lung, and needless disaster are facts of life. In 1973, the men voted to join the United Mine Workers Union. The company refused to sign the contract, and so began the battle of Harlan County, USA.
Which side are you on?
Without organization, you're a lone individual. Without influence, and without recognition of any kind.
They're treating us like that we're animals, dogs. Well, we aren't. We're American citizens.
Is it a fact that the Duke Power Company maintains housing for its employees that has no water and no indoor plumbing?
Yes, sir. We were attempting to move our people into trailers, upgrade our people into better housing.
We'll sit there and sweat when it's snowing. We'll stand right there until that UMWA contract is signed at Brookside.
We have made them dozens and dozens of proposals.
All of our life, we've been kicked around. We've been put in jail. We've been shot at. We've had dynamite thrown at us. And then you don't want us to have enough.
We're on Lafayette at the offices of Cabin Creek, so we're getting some of the background.
Arnold Miller won, and one of his promises was to organize the unorganized, and the first place was Harlan County. So, of course, that's where I went to see if he was really going to keep his promise and what that meant. So here we were.
You're a watchdog.
Well, no, curious.
Okay.
I was curious, not a watchdog. Okay. And so I did sound, and I went with a cameraman. I think Kevin Keating was the first cameraman, and assistant camera Ann Lewis. And the three of us went there sort of looking a little like hippies and odd. And at first, nobody trusted us. And the women gave us names like Florence Nightingale or Martha Washington when we asked them their names. But they said, okay, you can be here on the picket line tomorrow. Be there at 5 a.m. Mm-hmm. So we were all excited, and we went up Pine Mountain, and the next morning it was raining and bad weather, and there were no guardrails on Pine Mountain. And another car passed us, and our car went over and crashed. And we pulled all of our equipment out of the car and walked to the picket line. And then we were embraced, because word gets around in Harlan County when you do that. And we started living with the coal miners. Yeah. They took care of us. I mean, I think Harlan County was my most amazing film, because I learned what life and death was all about. I was told if I was ever caught alone at night that I'd be killed by the head gun thug. My first couple of days there, the head organizer decided I should have a gun of my own. And I didn't know what to do with the gun, but I picked a pretty little pink gun. And
a pink gun?
It had them,
like a pearl?
Yeah, a pearl handle.
Mother pearl type
of
handle.
Pink, yeah.
Okay, that's fine.
Never.
You still have it?
No.
What?
Because I never used it.
So it's a keepsake of sorts. And no. You never know when it comes in handy with one of your projects.
No.
You've interviewed, like, you know, Woody Allen and, you know.
I don't think
Dixie Chicks? There you go. Dixie Chicks. I'm sure they've got guns. They're from Texas. So is that true? Are they from Texas?
Yes.
Okay.
Lubbock.
Yeah, Lubbock. That's right. I have a couple of musical connections to your films, as I'm finding out. That one is I went to summer camp up in the Hudson Valley, a very progressive summer camp in the 70s. So right during that time, we were singing "Black When the Black Lung Gets You," that song. I don't know. But so I that's how I learned about the coal miners.
Right.
from folk songs that we
that's
sang
great.
In
was
the
it
70s.
A lefty?
Yeah, yeah. Big time. Big time.
What was the name of the camp?
Camp Thoreau.
Oh, wow.
The guy Greg Finger was on the board of the... who was the director of the camp. He was on the board at ACLU.
So you were singing
or
Black
the Center
Lung,
of Constitutional Rights.
The song Black Lung?
Yeah, we actually sang these. We sang...
do you remember any of it?
But I do remember, "When the Black Lung Gets You, it's the kiss of death." That's what I remember from the chorus.
Okay.
Okay.
Fun song for a 10-year-old kid to sing. Right. But we didn't know. We were just singing these songs. We sang a lot of Union songs. Uh-huh. Union Made.
Uh-huh. Solidarity, so there was Woody Guthrie. Forever.
Yes. Yes. These were camp songs.
Which Side Are You On?
We sang Which Side Are You On? All of those, yeah. We did. And I guess the other one would be, and one other connection. I worked at Sony Music for many years, so it was a... I remember when the Dixie Chicks were just kind of going from being like a country music act to a real mainstream rock pop act, you know, deservedly, you know, because they were just amazing. Some amazing albums came out of that period of time too, and I went to see them. Got tickets free, you know. Of course, I'm going to take all my friends. We went to see them at the Garden.
Yeah, we were there too.
I bet you had better seats than I did.
I think we stood in the back backstage, so we probably didn't have seats at all.
But it was a great concert. It was a very good concert. So around this time back, around after Carlin County and going into, let's say, American Dream, were you thinking of yourself as a progressive social issues filmmaker or storyteller, or you never even went there in your mind?
Oh, no, I did go there, and I wanted to really make films about people that you wouldn't know about, people, you know, who didn't have a voice, mm-hmm. and people whose stories, if you weren't there, nobody would know about. I mean, if we weren't in Harlan County, nobody would have known that story. And if we weren't on the picket line every single morning, more people would have been killed or hurt. So it just played right into everything I was feeling and thinking at that time.
Were there filmmakers that you had looked to before? Maybe you thought, oh, I can do this. Or maybe you're reading, like, maybe, I don't know, Howard Zinn or people that were describing these folks, like, from the unions.
Oh, sure. I mean, Howard Zinn was wonderful. And I remember I went to Boston after I had done Harlan County. I was visiting there, and he was doing a play on the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire at that time. Uh-huh. And I walked in, and it was overcrowded, and I didn't think I was going to get a seat. And I introduced myself to him, and he said, "You come right this way." And he let me sit down, and I couldn't believe that he would know who I was. Yes. Or let me see the play. But yes, I had a lot of people who were mentors, and a lot of people whose books I read and who I just thought so much of.
Yeah.
And my first job was with the Maisel brothers.
Yeah, I've heard of them. So no, you really do have a long, long, long relationship with the Maisels. But they were not making... Well,
they didn't do social issue films,
right.
but what they did was they really allowed filmmakers, particularly female filmmakers, to be part of their family.
I see.
And you would all sit in a room and look at material, and they listened to everybody. And your word meant something. So that gave you a lot of confidence that somebody cared about what you thought and what you felt and your essence of storytelling.
Which could go back to my earlier question about where you end up getting chutzpah, because there were actually people that were actively encouraging you during these films.
Oh, yes. Yeah, and also another guy I worked with, his name's Larry Moyer. Uh-huh. And he now lives in Sausalito. He's a painter. And he... filmmaker then, and he used to be friends with Herb Gardner, mm-hmm. and Shel Silverstein, and I was helping him do some painting on one of the books, Lefkadio, The Lion That Shot Back, sort of little helping him paint.
Like coloring and stuff.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And he was amazing to me because he was editing something. And he hired me as an editor, as an assistant editor. And he would leave, mm-hmm. and he would say, "Okay, I'm going out for 20 minutes. I want you to cut this down to 5 minutes by the time I get back." And he'd go, "Goodbye." And so I learned to tell a story in editing. And I also learned how to do sound. So there was nothing that somebody could tell me that can't be done, because I knew that it could.
Right.
That was smart.
And I think, you know, nobody gets anywhere on their own. You really need to have so many people working and helping you, and then you in turn help others to mm-hmm. be able to do the kind of work that you need to do.
So you went from American Dream. I don't want to jump too far ahead, but there was a documentary about Tyson. Is that what Liz said?
Yeah, there was a documentary about
That's
Tyson.
That's a gap in my knowledge, apparently.
Oh, okay.
There aren't too many, but I'll admit to
that. That was after American Dream.
Yeah.
I did that.
Yeah.
I have dates before. Of all of them.
Oh, you have them? Your hand right there.
Yeah.
It's right. There was no written test. It's only take home. But this is really helpful. Thanks.
Okay.
So beautiful. I can reference if necessary. Right. Yeah. I don't want to miss over anything.
Because I don't remember when they all were.
Okay.
Exactly.
Wow. I can edit that part. The part where I'm sort of sitting here like reading.
We're just hanging.
Okay. So American Dream was 1990. It's quite a bit timely. Oh, no nukes. Okay. That'd be a lot of fun to find yourself doing a rockumentary. I remember No Nukes. I remember the concert at Central Park.
Yeah.
But they also had one at Madison Square Garden, which was...
Yes.
That's the one that you shot.
Yeah.
Right.
You also did the one at Battery Park, too.
Oh, okay. Can people see that particular one, or is that... That's harder to see, maybe, that one?
No, Warner Brothers has it.
Okay. All right.
You wanted to jump you did to Tyson?
Well, I don't know. It was arbitrary, I guess, on Mike Tyson before... This is 93, so this was, right, just after...
American
obviously.
Dream.
And the rape charges just had come out, right? That's when you were following this story.
Right.
Yeah. And it was also notable, maybe because I'm going to guess it was your first profile on someone that was famous, maybe?
Yeah.
Yeah. How?
Well, yeah.
What went into your... What were you just ready to tackle something very different with this?
Well, no. I mean...
It was the first also sports-related. You could say on some level it was sports-related. I know, and I've...
Right.
No, you've done others since then.
Well, I mean, Diane Sokolow, mm-hmm. Who worked for Sony, called me, and she was a sports fanatic, and she asked me if I'd like to do a film on Mike Tyson. And I said, absolutely. And, you know, all the Desiree Washington mm-hmm. stuff was all just surfacing, and you know, when I first heard about it, I thought, okay, they just good, he probably did it, they got him. And then when she asked me to do that, I just let all of that go out of my mind, and I really wanted to see who Mike Tyson was. I wanted to see who Desiree Washington was. I wanted to get underneath and into the soul of sports people. And for me, that was sort of being like Eloise at the Plaza or something, mm-hmm. because, you know, if you're a woman, it's a little bit easier to ask guys about sports because they don't really expect you to know anything. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. it was pretty good.
So that worked to your advantage.
Yeah.
It was
wonderful. I mean, it was probably one of the most extraordinary experiences to really talk to all these people who knew mm-hmm. Mike so intimately.
I look at these guys, when I first came here, I thought they was, you know, God. I thought they was born like that, but they're not, you know. They're just ordinary people. I would like to be something like them. Not much with flamboyant or something arrogant, you could say, but just different from all the fighters nowadays. Because that's some way I just like being. I like being sometimes a little arrogant. A little bit, not much, just a little bit. And, you know, a little spoiled. I like that. That's me, and it's always going to be me. And I'm not going to try to change it for nobody.
Mike was cocky and shy at the same time. He was a little boy once you got to know him. But it took a bit of going through the layers to find this out. You know, he sometimes swaggered. He was a bad kid in his head.
The first time I saw Mike and Cuss was in September of 1980 when Jose Torres drove me up to Catskill, New York. It was an astounding experience. He was obviously a prodigy. It was like the first time I saw John Coltrane, or the first time I saw Bruce Springsteen, or the first time I read Norman Mailer. for the first time I saw Baryshnikov. It was clear this was somebody special.
To also learn that, you know, Mike didn't understand that when somebody said, you know, no, he thought it meant yes, because Customato wanted him to be the heavyweight champion of the world no matter what it took.
Yeah.
And, you know, young girls were giving him their underwear and their phone numbers, and they'd get into cars with him and they'd have a half an hour with him of sex or... Mm-hmm. And that would be the greatest notch on their gun. So he maybe really didn't understand it. But I think the most beautiful part of doing that film for me was talking to Desiree Washington's father, who was a very big boxing fan. And when Desiree called and said, you know, Daddy, I went out with Mike Tyson. And he went, oh, that's wonderful. Wait till I tell your grandfather, and that's terrific. And she said, oh, no, no, it wasn't very good. He raped me. And then the father said that he ran, you know, he went to go see his daughter, and that he went to hug her. And as he put his arms around her to hug her, she put her hands against his chest to pull him away from her. Mm. And he knew at that point that he had lost his daughter, that his daughter, who wanted to be president of the United States and had all these lofty dreams, that this had dramatically changed her, this experience.
She was damaged.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I learned so much about Mike. I learned so much about boxing. I learned so much about the what went into it. I learned sort of the subtleties and the frailties of Mike Tyson himself, and how insecure he was and how lonely he was and how he was looking for love.
So taking with you is not so much about forgiving or not, or judging, I should say, but more about understanding the subject and where they're coming from. And
there was no judgment. People were allowed to say what they wanted. But you got to see, hopefully, you know, these people in a whole different way. You went around a different corner than you would expect. There was no agenda to the film.
Right. Were you a conscious... Oh, of course, at this point, I'm sure now you've been making films for a number of years, and you had quite a bit of experience. And maybe right around the time of this Tyson documentary, you might have been seeing the first wave of changes in genre of documentary. As a viable sort of film genre. It's still fairly early, I know, but it might have been right around the time when what was starting to, maybe it was a couple of years later, though, when Hoop Dreams would come out, when Roger Me was coming out. I mean, all of a sudden there were some documentaries that actually had a commercial success.
Right. Exactly.
And were putting them on the map.
Exactly.
And so all of a sudden, what was your reaction to the beginning of this period of time? Because here you were already making films for close to 20 years, and
well, Harlan County showed in theaters, and American Dream showed in theaters, and I was so astounded that they were showing in theaters that when guys would take me out for dates, they'd ask me where I wanted to go, and I said Cinema 2.
So that's...
And I'd wait until the film was out.
Yeah,
right. Showing, and I'd walk up to some of the people and say, oh, well, do you think that's a good film, or should
your
I go see
testing,
it?
Your market testing, basically. Yeah.
No, I was like, please like it.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
And I wasn't market testing. It wasn't,
well, I meant, No, I know. You weren't judging. You weren't going to make decisions based on those reactions so much as just a kind of like figuring out whether or not people were responding to it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, and also so awed by the fact that it was showing there and people were actually there. And one time a bunch of people came out and said, oh, it was a terrible film. And then I realized that they had seen another film and that it wasn't Harlan County. But that's the extent. I mean, it was very good that, you know, not too many people asked me for dates during that
period.
But you
took dates to the films?
I did. No, I made them sit outside with me until the film came out.
All right. Well, you can have very deep conversations during that period of time while you're waiting. It's uninterrupted time together on a bench. That's funny. Was there a point, though, had you gotten, like, bad reviews had you gotten? Was there like a low point?
Yeah,
in
there
here
was.
Were
a,
you
there was
ever
a,
thought about throwing everything away, or
oh,
like
no.
maybe you were going the wrong direction, or
no.
I don't know.
No, I mean, I got a very bad review for Harlan County.
Really?
Yeah.
What, like the mainstream press? Or?
Mm-hmm. I think it was John Simon and Frank Rich both hated the film.
Well, wasn't Frank Rich reviewing theater at the time, though?
No, this was before theater. I wish he had been doing theater at the time. Yeah. He said I had about that it was a terrible film and it had as much interest as a half-baked tourist would have.
Did he ever...
I went up to him at a lunch, and I said, that's really what you thought of Harlan County? I said, maybe you were having a bad day and somebody disappointed you. Would you just...
Is it after the Oscar?
No, this was before.
Okay.
This was after the New York Film Festival. That was the review he wrote. And I said, well, would you look at it again? And he went, no, I wouldn't look at it again. But I tried.
I mean, he's, you know, kind of turned into a more reasonable... I mean, also people had a lot of problems with him as a, the theater, you know, too much of a power monger as a theater reviewer too. But since then, it seems like he's kind of been able to get out of his own way to some degree. I don't know.
Right, but that was a really bad review.
Oh, well...
And nobody would tell me about it. Because I said, well, the Times, was that good? Or the Daily News? I guess he was writing for the Post then. I don't remember one of them. And they told me about everyone but that one. And finally, I had to go out and get it because nobody would tell me.
Yeah.
And I read it.
Well, fortunately, it didn't discourage you from moving forward because...
No,
it
made
quite a
me mad.
And Elroy just kind of put a little piss and vinegar in your...
Right.
And when did you begin Cabin Creek? When did the...
During Harlan County.
Oh, so it really... Oh, so
it came from Harlan County because there's a place called Cabin Creek. And I never wanted to forget it. And so I decided I wanted to name my company Cabin Creek Films.
That's terrific.
And it was, you know, what they call a holler. And there were young girls that were prostitutes at the age of 11 and 12 and... It was such poverty, the way that people lived.
So what you're saying, the Cabin Creek was a holler.
Yeah.
That's what they called it, a holler?
Yeah, instead of a hollow, holler.
I see. Okay. Oh, I didn't know the origin story of the Cabin Creek. So.
Yeah.
Okay. And so it's nice because, yeah, forever have this association with your first success and first story and first...
Well, there was a film that we did as a collective before that, and that was called Winter Soldier. It was Vietnam veterans giving testimony of what they did in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And I did that with a collective of people. And we lived with Vietnam veterans in Alamuchi, New Jersey for a long time during the editing. And so that was pretty extraordinary experience. And that was before Harlan County.
Oh, okay. And who was anybody in that collective that you're that's still, you know, I'm assuming everybody is probably somewhat productive?
Well, let's see. Nancy Baker, who's a great editor, and Bob Fury, a great director and also a great DP, and Fred Aronson, who lives in California, and he's producing, and a lot of people.
Okay.
Still.
Sorry, I missed that one, too. Well, I'm going to have to figure out how to catch up.
I'll give you copies of everything.
Thank you. Oh, appreciate it.
Your spare time, you can watch them all.
I wish that were my spare time. Unfortunately, it takes up too much of my
lifetime.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I have a few other things. So, I guess the next one worth mentioning is Wild Man Blues, and it was in a particular interesting story too, or timing of it. Not going to even remotely delve with the more recent post Golden Globe,
right?
Because I don't really go. I don't get involved at all in that conversation. It's a rabbit hole, first of all. Second, it's not my business. But the film was, in the sense that Mike Tyson was around the time of a controversial period.
The Desiree Washington
scandal, I guess we could say. But
Mike Tyson was in jail for the rape of Desiree Washington.
So there you go.
Time.
Okay, that's as blunt as one can be. And then also right around this time, this is Wild Man Blues, which not long after he and Sun Yi formed a romantic relationship.
Exactly.
So that we can say that.
Yes.
So this was coming out of a period, a darker period for Alan.
Well, you could say it was a dark period, but it was also a light period for him, too. Because, when I was first asked to do the film, this guy from Chicago called up, and he just said, would you like to do a film on Woody Allen and his jazz tour? And I think he'll be taking Sun Yi with him. And I said, you know, of course I would love to do that. Mm-hmm. And my friend said, oh, Barbara, you can't do that. And I said, of course I can do that. And
that's just fuel for the fire.
Oh,
for
yeah.
As far as you're concerned, when you're hearing you can't, apparently it seems.
Well, they just meant, you. Why would you want to do that? That would hurt Mia Farrow. And why would you want to, you know,
well,
add
to that?
About that?
What did you think about that?
I thought, I really want to find out who she is and what's happening, and I want to make it not just a film about his jazz tour, but really see what their relationship is. And I was very lucky, because when I went to meet Woody for the first time, we talked about everything other than the film. We talked about David Blaine, the magician. We talked about...
What did he have to say about David Blaine?
We both knew him. Liked him.
Okay.
And so we were
Must have been very young at the time. Yeah. He was just starting. Okay.
Yeah, and so we were just enjoying...
Understood. It was a way of connecting...
Talking.
...off something lighter.
Yes.
Yeah.
When we knew we had something else to talk about. So putting it off as long as possible.
Yeah.
But then I also realized, okay, well, Woody only gives you maybe 20 or 30 minutes, so I better get to it and talk about this film. And so I said, so are you looking forward to going to all these places? And suddenly he just changed and he said, no, I didn't know there were so many places and I really don't want to go. I can go to one or two of them, but not all of these places. And most of these places I'm afraid to go to, just don't want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I just was inside wishing, I wish I had a camera right this minute. This is such a great way to start. And I said, so Woody, I can film whatever I want, right? There's no holes barred.
Had he seen your films? Do you know at that point?
I don't know.
You don't even know, right?
I don't even know.
I wouldn't assume that.
I mean, obviously, he wanted me to do it.
You were already vetted, obviously, so...
Yeah, so I was meeting with him, and I was doing it.
Right.
We were having our first conversation about it.
Yes.
And so he said, yes, you can do whatever you want.
He did say to me years ago... that if he had to choose a career, he would choose music.
And now I give out my laundry.
No starch, and do we want it back with holes in it, or do you want it the way we send it in?
You know, the tour started off just me and the banjo player saying what a nice idea it would be to play a couple of places in Europe just for fun.
Woody, be careful, play well, eh?
Maybe here for Berlusconi or Mick Jagger or somebody. For me, it's a total digression from reality.
Are you ready?
I'm lost. This whole trip between the fans and the responses and the places. It's the same photo, no? Beautiful. Thank you so much. You have to be careful. The mayor has many enemies. This is where we sleep. The ceilings are just a little higher. It'd be perfect. Where's my coat?
I love him. You have humor. You are so intelligent.
Oh, don't stop. Don't stop. They won't pay 10 cents to see one of my movies, but passing in a gondola, they love it.
Don't think for a moment that you are what you are by yourself.
He stuck to his word. I mean, I got to go into his hotel room early in the morning, watch the meeting breakfast, watch him... going swimming, watch him staying in all these wild hotel rooms, watching him going to Turin and other places that creeped him out, being very depressed and having Sun Yi comfort him when she could, and really watch this relationship bloom, you know, as well as his music, and also making fun of himself. You know, he'd look around backstage and he couldn't find a reed for his clarinet, and he'd want to put on his old man sweater, and, you know, it was just brilliant. And she was so great. She was just very gracious And she would say, Woody, I don't understand. Everybody's standing around you and you'll only talk to the person who's in charge. Why don't you talk to everybody as a group? Or, you know, if we came in, she'd say, have you eaten? Are you thirsty? Do you want anything?
Had anybody ever been telling him this since he was a kid, maybe, trying to socialize him on some level? You know, like, well, nobody was telling him these things. I don't know what his relationships are with his past relationships. I don't know, or, you know, his romantic partnerships, and I don't know what his relationship was with his sister. I just know that it sounds like Sun Yi was trying to, like, here, this is how you behave.
Yeah, as getting him to go places,
right,
and to do things. And Woody, for me, was just like one of the characters in his film. It was like he jumped off the screen and there he was. So
yeah. And did anything, like, end up... Well, it's funny because it wouldn't be too many years later where I guess most of his financing started coming from Europe and he started making films in Europe.
Yeah.
Shortly after this period, right?
Right. Well, he loved London because there was no sunshine.
Oh, and they speak English.
He doesn't. Yeah, and they speak English. But he likes New York better because can order things at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning if you're hungry, like Chinese food or something.
He's a neurotic Jewish person. Like,
no, but he is, but he's very wonderful and very deep and very smart and very talented human being.
Yeah, to say the least.
And I had a lot of fun on that trip.
Yeah.
And I had a wireless on Woody and I could hear. And so we got to eat where they ate, which were the best restaurants. So I'd report to the rest of the crew, okay, the bass is good. We should all get the bass.
Oh, you were, you know? Yes.
Yeah.
He was bugged.
Yeah.
So you got to...
I got to hear everything.
That's funny.
You know,
yeah,
what was good at this restaurant. Or,
yeah, that's funny.
Yeah.
Were those recorded for posterity? Were those, or it was just you were overhearing?
I think just the Nagra was on, not on record. But
that's too bad.
Yeah, that would have been
fun. A lot of those suggestions may still hold up in this.
Yes.
And then by this time now, you're well along. You had a kind of work, I guess, with celebrities.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's, even the Dixie Chicks, that story came out of another scandal in a sense. Mm-hmm. It was almost the kind of reverse scandal. Where this time it's are justified in
right,
at least to us. But, you know, in terms of being anti-W. But Natalie Maines had made the comment that she was ashamed of being from the same state of, right?
Not long ago. Say it exactly. Before. Just so you know, we're ashamed that the President of the United States is from Texas. And that was the entire comment that got her blacklisted.
Right. Oh, yeah. And I don't think people may recall just how threatened they were at the time of that, you know, past kind of racist some of the... But their lives were threatened regularly and their families, I'm assuming. And
yeah, exactly. They were threatened. They were told if they went to Dallas, they'd be killed. There were letters that were written that Natalie Maines was going to die.
On stage.
Yes.
Right, when she,
right,
when she
on
would
stage,
have to walk on stage.
And you'd watch, and the other two would sort of move a little further away from her. But what that film was about friendship. It was about standing up for what you believed in. It was about how they backed each other up. It's as if every woman who saw that film wanted girlfriends, just like, you know, Natalie, Emily, and Marty. Mm.
Speech is fine, but by God, you don't do it outside of the country and you don't do it mass publicly.
Being ashamed of our president means being ashamed of our country. Move to France, Dixie Chicks.
Strong. Right. City say it. Jungle, four games to play. I'm trapped in a heart of it, trying to get away. I'm freezing the country.
It's time to tell y'all the American Red Cross wouldn't take $1 million from us.
Well, you do know that George W. Bush is the honorary chairman.
This whole week they didn't play us.
Well,
this whole week they didn't play us.
No one boycotted you.
Silence! That was
a boycott.
It's not a boycott.
How? How is it not a boycott? They haven't been playing our music for a few weeks.
Boycott is when someone says, we are not playing.
Simon, actions speak louder than words.
What's the difference?
Tell me the difference.
station. They pretend to support him, but they won't play him. We call and ask, and they won't.
No other artist that we play on the radio would get the kind of hate mail and complaint calls and I'm never listening to you again. I'm never doing business with you again. No one gets that. I could probably put Marilyn Manson on the radio station and not get that kind of negative feedback, even though we're a country station.
It deepened them. It allowed them to write songs. They won, you know, 9 Grammys after that. And their films were, songs were activist songs and very political and coming from their gut. So,
yeah. That brings up actually something that is curious. You know, everybody knows documentaries. You have an idea of what you're, when you're going into it, like what kind of story you want to tell, and then you don't know really what's going to happen, of course. So that's the beauty of it. And I'm wondering if when you're making a film like
Dixie Chicks, Shut Up and Sing.
The Dixie Chicks, Shut Up and Sing. It's good to have them in the title. Good. Sell some copies.
Well, you're good on marketing, right?
I figure I'm learning a lot. I mean, I see nothing's by accident.
There
are different times when, like, the story and you're discovering the story, what that film was about. Does it sometimes even happen after you've finished it and seen it and you realize, oh, I made a movie about that?
Well, the beauty of documentary is that you can research and you can think and you can decide all you want, but once you get there, you just have to go with what happens because you don't know what decisions people are going to make. You don't know what direction they're going to go in. And who knew? I mean, the Dixie Chicks maybe wouldn't have been such a tight-knit group. Maybe they were afraid. There were times when, you know, you didn't know what was going to happen. Maybe they wouldn't have a career after this, and did that really matter to them? Or, I mean, it's so many different influences and levels and complexities when you're out there. It's just, and you're privy to them. You just get to follow them around and see them in their most intimate moments.
And vulnerable.
And they no longer really become celebrities. They're people. They're people who have choices to make. They're people who, you know, are just like everybody else who have to figure out what's right and what's wrong for them to do. And the celebrity thing leaves
pretty quick
when you get into very intimate situations with them.
Right. And it's I see there is a kind of a theme that's emerged throughout these films, going back to your earlier films too, that each one is in such a volatile, there's a volatile level to almost every story. You know, of obviously the ones that are a little bit more obvious when you talk about Harlan County and there's, you know, a strike going on and an American Dream where people are in extreme situations and very, very stressed out, to say the least. And you're in the middle of that. And then also when you're talking about like a Mike Tyson going through the scandal and picking up the pieces and a Woody Allen going through his and the Dixie Chicks going with there's always this possibility of the story just going completely off the rails. In every one of those, I could see.
Oh, absolutely. But the great things that happened, I mean, for example, when we were editing Wild Man Blues, Woody would call me in the editing room all the time and say, okay, so when can I come in and see it? And I'd say, Woody, it's 5 hours long. And so then he'd call, and I'd say, Woody, it's 3 hours long. And so he said, I can take 3 hours. And so I said, all right. Come on in. Uh-huh. So he and Suni came in and watched it. And it was as if they were seeing their relationship happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, Woody was sitting there and he had his finger in his mouth and mm-hmm. she had her arm through his and the two of them were in the front of their chairs. And it was wonderful. Larry Silk was the editor and I just watched them watching the film.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you think people are teetering or you think they're at the end of, you know, their hooks or whatever. And what happens is that you see the brightness and the beauty when the Dixie Chicks, they came in here to look at the film for the first time in Fine Cut and each one of them was so nervous through the whole thing, and each one was in a different position. One of them had her knees locked around her, and the other one was sitting right. with her arms very close, and they just watched it.
Yeah.
And Marty, near the end of the film, said, you know, I would give up my career for Natalie if it meant she would be at peace. And Natalie started crying in the screening room, and she said, I didn't know you said that. I didn't know you would do that. And they just, you know, embraced each other. So you just see so many beautiful things coming out, and it's such surprises for the characters in the film. So even though they've had a hard time, they've had so much richness between themselves.
I got moved just now when you said that, sir. But I can imagine they may almost think it's worth it. If their families' lives were in potential jeopardy, I'm sure they would have.
Well, but it made them strong, and it made them tough. And sometimes when you're under attack, you know, it sharpens you.
Oh, absolutely.
And it allows you to soar.
Yeah. It's actually a pretty common question I ask a lot of in particular, the documentary filmmakers, because so often they're making a film about a subject or subjects, and they'll invite them to see the film. And I wonder, because the critical response is so nice and the audience responses are very nice, but you know, as I always say, the subject's response and their endorsement is so important. Has it gone in a way you didn't expect, or I assume because of the level of respect, and because you are, these are long-winded questions, I apologize, it's
No,
I try to edit my question after the fact because I need to get to the point sometimes.
But you know
where I'm going.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. Yeah. American Dream was a toughie.
Yeah.
And nobody saw it who was in it until it premiered at the New York Film Festival. And I had all of the different characters there. There was Ray Rogers and Jim Guyette, who were part of this group called P9, who were fighting against their international union, who didn't want them to go on strike.
They were part of the local union, in other words.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then there was Louis Anderson, who was part of the international union. And the whole film is about, you know, the three-tiered, the international union, the company, and the local union all fighting during a time of real recession and a cutting of wages. And so all of them were up there with me, and I had Louis Anderson on one side of me and Ray Rogers and Jim Guyette on the other side, and they just started fighting and screaming with each other. And
this is during the Q&A after the premiere.
After the film.
Okay.
Yeah. Their disdain for each other and their
dislike
for each other. It just kept coming out. It was, nothing had changed, and each one held tight to their position.
Didn't budge.
Until finally someone in the audience stood up and said, what is wrong with you guys? This film is a brilliant film. It shows what, you know, a company can do to really hurt workers, and you guys should all be working together and not working apart. And then the whole audience stood up and clapped, and that sort of silenced the bickering and the fighting.
One should hope it would.
But, yeah.
So, okay,
it
that was
gets
a good example.
Hard.
That's
and
a good example.
I was very nervous that night.
Yeah.
Because I knew.
Right. Was it 81, 82, right around there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I also, you know, and none of the sides had known what I had filmed. I mean, I filmed guys who were deciding to cross a picket line, who had been union all their lives just because they couldn't feed their families anymore. And they broke down in tears. And I filmed meetings with the international union trying to plot how to destroy what Jim Guyette and Ray Rogers were doing. And I filmed meetings of Ray and Jim trying to plot to destroy whatever the international union was doing. So I had all of that material. And that was tough. So I had to keep it all
still
silent.
Yeah. And then also, just to squeeze it in too, I definitely want to know, like, did Marielle Hemingway, she obviously was supporting the film, so I assume she was not displeased with the turnout of that film.
Well,
You know, because here we're dealing with suicide and depression.
Mental illness.
And although the two are
depression
certainly tied together in many ways, but mental illness and also seemingly genetic mental illness, where we're talking about it going through generations of a family.
Well, when Mariel and I met, we talked about all of this, and she said that she didn't want to leave a stone unturned. And she didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And she let me film everything I wanted to film, including a section that was very difficult for me, which was a section about her father having some sexual contact with her two sisters and Mariel seeing that. And that had never been discussed before or anyone said anything. And I would be pacing during the editing, trying to find out every single little thing that she said to me about this so that I could put it in and make sense of it. And I just thought for myself that if people are really going to understand what alcoholism does and mental illness does, that this is something that's very prevalent and it needs to be mentioned. And that was one of the things I was worried about that she wouldn't like when I showed her the film.
When I was young, I would often hike these hills. I knew if I didn't get outside that I'd just want to cry.
My father was the oldest son of Ernest Hemingway.
Cheers.
It was kind of like the Kennedy family. The Kennedys had these horrible tragedies, and we were sort of the other American family that had this horrible curse.
My grandfather, Ernest, is one of the greatest writers of the 20th century, and yet he suffered tremendous mental illness. I had come from 7 suicides, perhaps more.
And I had also, we had also found 43 hours of film about her sister Margot that she didn't even know existed. And I didn't tell her that I found it. And she would, because I was afraid that if she knew I had it, then she wouldn't be as free with her memories because she didn't know whether.
All of a sudden now there was a second perspective. Right, yeah.
That her memories were correct. I mean, even her memories of, you know, her mother sitting in the kitchen with her legs up on the sink and seeing the kitchen as yellow and, you know, robin's egg blue, and the fighting between her parents and wine time. And she just never knew that all of this was real. And so showing the film to her for the first time, it was just about finished. And I went to L.A., and she came in, and she and a friend of hers and I sat on the couch, and also our executive producer from OWN, Erica Forstadt. The four of us sat in the room together, and at the very beginning of the film, she just started to cry because she thought the film was going to be all about her. And then suddenly she saw her parents, and suddenly she saw her sister, and she saw all this material she had never seen before. She'd never seen her parents on film before. And she was totally enthralled in it because her kids had never seen their grandparents except in some old faded photos. You know, it's very dysfunctional family. And for her, she suddenly, for the first time, really understood the pain that her sister was going through. So
it turned out all right.
Yeah, it turned out to be something so much more than she ever thought that it would be. And it, for me as a filmmaker, it had complexities.
Because you were following her right through her current
life.
And so that was what she was more privy to, not the what you heard, the backstory and the history.
1984,
Right, and just the emphasis on the on the legacy of the family. And,
exactly.
It was very compelling.
And I mean, we had you know, Margot interviewing her dad on what it meant to be the son of Ernest Hemingway.
Yeah.
I mean, just things that everybody wants to know.
Of course.
And Margot talking about not being loved and not knowing what she was going to do. And when she went to the Betty Ford Clinic, nobody ever coming to see her from the family to visit her, and that she was so lonely when she got out that she had to hire a hooker to come just to hold her to get the pain out. I mean, so it got very deep.
Yeah. One can definitely, there's a lot of questions I can think of to ask about that level of sensitivity, and you're in the trust, and I guess at that point you just, you know, do your best to respect that trust, and it's pretty plain. Hopefully you know better, and the choices and when to shoot and when to, you know, what to include in the public.
Well, that wasn't, you know, shooting. And, that had been shot.
Yeah. Right. You know, in terms of what to include in the edit and all these different issues, and it's a heavy duty. Last thing, I guess I just want to make sure we squeeze in, because I want to let you get back to your work. And thanks again, by the way. It means a lot to me that you gave me all of this time. It really does. You're now embarking on what seems to would be a lot of fun, another music-oriented project. I don't know the story of Sharon Jones. I don't know her backstory. I know I picked up the most recent album in anticipation of our conversation.
Uh-huh.
So it just,
so Sharon Jones.
Yeah.
Sharon Jones.
I don't know how much you can talk about it, considering that you're just embarking on it.
Yeah, I can. Uh-huh. She's so amazing. She's a great soul singer. One of her first jobs in her life was being a guard at Rikers Island.
And what?
She used to sing in her church. And when she went to Sony... They said, you'll never make it. You're too short. Mm-hmm. You're too fat. And you're too black. And you won't make it.
And that might have been, by the way, from a black person saying that, by the way. I just want you to know that's that business, we should just say, is so, well, historically so based on the division of race. It's the history is shameful, you know. But I just thought I'd mention that.
But
anyway,
Sharon really had something that she wanted to do, and singing is her heart and her spirit, and she got connected with a group called the Dap Kings.
How long do I have to wait for you, honey, before a girl
She's on tour right now. She had pancreatic cancer.
And survived it?
Just,
well, obviously.
Just recently.
Oh, my God.
And we filmed her in the chemo units. And there she was, like sunshine there, telling stories and singing and talking to people. And I filmed her last chemo on New Year's Eve day. And she has a new album out, Give the People What They Want. She just had a big show at the Beacon, and she didn't know whether she could do it or not. She hadn't been able to really exercise her lungs, mm-hmm. and do what she needed to do. And about a half an hour before she went on, she said, Barbara, I just don't know who I am anymore. I just don't know if I can go out there. And she said, and if I can't dance, she said, dancing is what I'm all about, dancing and singing. I'm just not going to stand there and not move. And she said, so who am I? Who is this Sharon Jones? And they called her out, and she killed it. Mm-hmm. She was wonderful. Mm-hmm. She danced. She sang. She just was brilliant. It was as if all the adrenaline she had saved up, and this is right after her last chemo. She went out there, and now she's on tour.
That's remarkable, because that is a cancer is pretty serious, but pancreatic cancer,
very serious.
Yeah, that's usually a death sentence for most people.
Well, she taught me what it was to be positive, to take what you have and let it grow, and to always have a good word and not sink into the depths of depression, not that she wouldn't cry and she wouldn't be upset and she wouldn't question herself. Mm-hmm. But there was more of an inner strength of, it's not my time to go. I've got a lot more singing and a lot more people. I've got a long bucket list out there.
Yeah. Is she, like, roughly what age is she at this
57.
Point? 57. Oh, yeah. Well, there you go. Lots of years ahead for a singer. Are you shooting the tour?
Or well, are you, I'm going. You shot I'm most... leaving Thursday. Okay. Going on the bus with her in Milwaukee for a while. And we're going to film another concert in Lawrence, Kansas. Mm-hmm. And we'll see what happens.
Where is she from?
She's... Well, she grew up in the Bronx.
Okay,
but
yeah.
She
worked at Rikers, so it's an island right off that.
But she also grew up in Augusta, but left
Maine?
When she was three.
Okay. Oh, so her early childhood.
Yeah,
well,
but left
toddler,
when she was three to come to the Bronx.
Okay. So. In Maine? Is that Augusta?
No. Helen? In South Carolina.
Oh, okay. Because there's an Augusta.
Right. Not in Maine. In the South.
Oh, very well. Okay, very good. So Sharon Jones will look forward to it. And then I'm going to guess, let's see, we're talking about you're going towards March, April. So hopefully maybe by, what are you thinking, the holidays? You'll have a movie?
We'll see. We start editing mid-April.
Oh, as soon as that?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So you have shot most of it, in other words, because through the illness and all. The recovery.
Yes.
Which is more important. You know, and maybe we'll get a much briefer chat in before around the time of the film.
No, then, absolutely.
You know, and maybe you'll be back at the New York Film Festival. Well, you can do better than that, lazy bunch of programmers. I'm kidding. In fact, my next thing is new directors talking to the couple of the programmers at MoMA and Film Society together. Uh-huh. Priest brokering. I'm like, you know.
No, that's great.
It's fun to have them on. Yeah, talk about new directors, new films. Anyway. Thank you very much for...
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And, I think this is going to be a fantastic show. We got over an hour, so I don't know if you meant to give me that much time, but...
Well, of course, and I want you to use clips of the film.
Oh, yeah, I absolutely will.
Okay.
I will. So thank you, Barbara Koppel, and you've now survived. You survived Mike Tyson, Woody Allen, the Dixie Chicks, Miners, Meat... Processors.
Packers,
excuse me. And now FilmWatch
Radio.
Gregory Peck. Oh, well, that's true. We're going to look. We'll include all this in my show, in the notes and everything. I put a post and everything like that. We'll have the. We'll hopefully, there's a few people out there may not be as familiar with your work as most of my audience is, and that they'll go and see all these films or revisit them, because they were definitely worthy of revisiting. So again, I look forward to future conversations. Thank you.
Oh, likewise. Thank you.
I am so pleased, just really thrilled. Again, thanks to everybody at Cabin Creek Films. And especially Ms. Koppel, Mr. Cassidy, and everybody else. Thanks again for that. And also to the folks at the Criterion Collection for providing me with my copy, now signed, of Harlan County, USA. I did not have my own personal copy, but it is on the Criterion Collection. You can check it out. And I think if you have Hulu Plus, you can watch Harlan County on Hulu Plus. So, So thanks for everybody who's been listening regularly for the last however many episodes. But now I can kind of feel like, moving forward and not getting caught up with the number of episodes anymore. Coming up also, I've got a bunch of new episodes coming up. One of them is, I'm very excited about, a meeting with my old friend Orner Tuckell. Orner is, you know, made the movie that he cast me in a couple of summers ago called Richard's Wedding. It's now, he's got a new film. It's called Summer Blood, and it is premiering. It's having its world premiere at the Tribeca Film Festival. Orner is coming up actually twice. He's going to be on later this month on my Fandor-sponsored episode because Richard's Wedding is on Fandor now. You can see it right on Fandor. You can subscribe to Fandor and see it, or you can try a two-week trial period and to evaluate the site, but I promise you, you're going to love it and want to subscribe. And if you do check out Richard's Wedding, because you know, I think you'll enjoy that. And I watched Summer of Blood, and it is as funny. And I see why Tribeca chose it. So, and then Orner is going to be back on next month on our live podcast. Put in your calendars right now, folks. I can confirm more details. We're going to be having our first FilmWax Radio live podcast. If you live in New York City, you may want to consider coming out to it. It's going to be in Williamsburg, Brooklyn at Videology on April 12th. That's a Saturday if you're in town at 5 o'clock in the evening. We are going to first have Dan Nuxel, who is the director of programming of Rooftop Films, and he's going to make an announcement about the summer 2014 slate. And so I'm assuming he'll be making announcements about opening weekends and other things they've confirmed. You know, most of the films have been confirmed at this point, although I suppose they're still figuring out lots of the scheduling. Makes sense. After Dan is on, we're going to have a panel of guests, which will include, as I mentioned, Orner, but also I have these two filmmakers coming up. Each of them had a big success at, I believe, at Sundance. Desiree Akhavan, who is part of the Brooklyn Filmmakers Collective, will be coming with her new comedy. It's called Appropriate Behavior. I saw it and I loved it, truly. And Desiree will be on the panel. And then I'm also going to be bringing up Jillian Robespierre, who has also a new film, which I just saw, which is going to be having a New York premiere soon at the New Directors New Films series called Obvious Child, and starting, and that too, two really funny films by two very talented young filmmakers. So Jillian and Desiree and Orner will be on the panel, and we may have one or two other surprises, but it's all set. So please do. We'll put up a Facebook event soon, and I'm, as you can tell, maybe in the way I'm describing it, I'm very excited about it. I just want to remind you that I also have conversations coming up with Liz Garbus, a full hour-plus conversation with her. We have a conversation coming up with Azazel Jacobs. Azazel has made a couple of films, including Mama's Man and Terry, and he's now at the helm of a HBO series called Dahl and M, which is going to be premiering and broadcasting in a couple of weeks. And Azza is the director of all six episodes of this, what is a six-episode series. I don't know if it's going to be back for a second season or what, but it was very entertaining. It's actually a British comedy, but it's almost entirely shot in Hollywood. I think they had one episode that was shot in the UK, but almost entirely set up. And it stars Emily Mortimer. Of course, we know the actress from, among other things. She's also on another HBO series, The Newsroom, and co-stars Dolly Wells. Anyway, Azazel, who is the director of this series, is coincidentally happens to have been also a camper at the same summer camp that I keep going on about. It. You know, when I was a camp counselor, he was there as a camper, so I don't think he was ever in my bunk, but he is just another connection that we share. So I'm very excited to be welcoming Azazel Jacobs to FilmWax Radio. And then we'll be also welcoming back, after a long hiatus, FilmWax Radio friend Robert Green. Robert was on a couple of times very early on in the series. So if you go way back in the archives, you can listen to a very, very green Adam Chartoff and a very less green Robert Green. So Robert will be on. He's got a couple of new projects, including one called The Actress, which will be screening at the series at Lincoln Center called The Art of the Real very shortly. So I'm excited to have Robert back and much, much more. So that's what I wanted to tell you about. And also just to always urge you guys to continue to, you know, put the word out on the street about what I'm doing here, and to, you know, subscribe to the show on iTunes. Even if you listen, go to the Rooftop site and you listen there, which is fine. Do me a favor and also go to the iTunes and subscribe and leave a star rating. Because it helps the show move up the ranks and becomes more visible. And with more people streaming and downloading the show, I could get more help, more sponsorships, etc. And it will, you know, it's just a tremendously helpful thing. I can spend more time doing it and continue to get great guests. So thank you very much for everybody tuning in and for supporting Film Wax Radio for all these 200 episodes. It's mind-boggling how many episodes I've done, isn't it? But we have many more segments to post ahead, many more people to welcome onto the show, and hopefully many more people that will listen in, and so we all can come together here in this community called Film Wax Radio. And I'm your mayor, Adam Shartoff. You've been listening to Film Wax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films. Until next time, thank you very much.
Mother, do you think they'll drop the bomb? Mother, do you think they'll like this song? Mother, do you think they'll try to break my balls? Ooh, mother, should I build a wall? Mother, should I run for president? Mother, should I trust the government? Now, baby, baby, don't you cry. Mother didn't need to be so high.